You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many kids love kung fu movies, but Matthew Polly took that a lot further. He dropped out of Princeton at the age of 21 and traveled to China so he could study martial arts at the world-famous Shaolin Temple. Mr. Polly writes about becoming the first American to become an official Shaolin monk in his new book, American Shaolin, Flying Kicks, Buddhist Monks, and the Legend of Iron Crotch, an Odyssey in the New China. It's published by Gotham Books, and it's brought Matthew Polly to my show today. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Couldn't you have studied kung fu in the United States?
Oh, I certainly could have, and I did study kung fu when I was in college. But like a lot of students, you study kung fu once or twice a week, and I really wanted to learn it properly. So I went to the Shaolin Temple, which is where it all started.
Was your family supportive of this?
My family thought I was nuts, and they may have been right. They're good Kansas folk, Reagan-loving Republicans, and so the idea that their son, who they'd sent off to college, wanted to go to the Shaolin Temple kind of freaked them out.
And it had to be Shaolin Temple, not another temple where you might have learned kung fu?
Well, I certainly could have learned somewhere else, but I asked my teacher where I could go, my Chinese teacher, where I could go, and he said the Shaolin Temple, which is where it all started, so why not go there?
How much of this was based on the fantasies that were stimulated by kung fu movies, and how much of it was a matter of trying to engage in a form of self-improvement?
Well, I certainly had the fantasy, because I was one of those 98-pound weaklings who got picked on, of trying to be tough and trying to be a fighter. So I saw David Carradine in Kung Fu and thought, I would like to be like him or Bruce Lee. And then part of it was simply a process of trying to learn what the real culture was like.
But you put together a list, things that are wrong with Matt, and you hope to correct them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
One, ignorant. Am I going to embarrass you?
Not at all. I put it in the book.
Ignorant. Two, cowardly. Still a boy, not a man. Four, unattractive to the opposite sex. Five, spiritually confused.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of us, some people have an inner voice, and I sort of have this inner to-do list of things that are wrong with me. I think a lot of people have something similar. And so part of wanting to go to China was to get over this feeling of being cowardly, having been sort of the picked-on boy.
How easy is it to find the Shaolin Temple?
Well, it was 1992, so now it's a Google search. I mean, you could probably get a video, satellite photo of it. But back then, no one knew where it was.
Could this have happened earlier during the years when Mao Zedong was in power?
No. The interesting thing is, during the Cultural Revolution, the Shaolin Temple was more or less destroyed. And it wasn't until Deng Xiaoping took over that the Shaolin Temple was sort of rebuilt, based on Jet Li's movie, The Shaolin Temple.
So now, is it a cultural icon to the Chinese as well as to people in other parts of the world?
It is. It's one of, in Henan province where it's located, it's one of their most popular tourist attractions. You know, Kung Fu and Zen Buddhism is one of the great cultural contributions that anyone's given, and so they really honor the Shaolin Temple.
Now, I thought Zen Buddhism was a Japanese creation.
But Zen Buddhism is the Japanese word for it. The Chinese word is Chan, and the Zen actually... the Japanese got it by coming over in the 12th century to the Shaolin Temple and brought it back to China, to Japan, and then from Japan it went over here to the U.S.
Did you speak Mandarin or Hunanese?
Hunanese, yes. I spoke Mandarin. I'd studied it in school, but I was kind of like a clever, 12-year-old. But I was the only white person in the whole village, so I very quickly had to learn.
Also, but I'm sure people indulged you because it was so cute that you were speaking a little bit.
They were very generous to me. That's true.
Once you found the temple, was it difficult to get to, first of all?
It was. I actually landed in Beijing, and I had a Fodor's book of China with a map, and I went around Tiananmen Square asking people, Shaolin Zidzinar, where's the Shaolin Temple? And I finally found an old woman who came from Henan province, and she said, it's in Henan, and pointed
Then you go to Henan, and it's not hard to find?
Now, I caught a train to Zhengzhou, and then I asked one of the key girls at a hotel where it was, and then I got on a bus, and then I got over there. So it was like a plane, a train, a bus to get to the Shaolin Temple.
And once you found it, was it a problem to get the monks to take you seriously, to teach you?
Well, the interesting thing about it at the time is that the Communist Party had taken over the whole village, and they had gone totally capitalistic. So when I walked in the room and said I wanted to study for 2 years, they said, that's fine. You know,
you got money, we'll do it.
If you got the money, baby, you can do it.
How did you have money enough to pay for that?
Well, I had a little money from the college fund, and my parents helped me out a bit. And it wasn't, you know, compared to going to doing anything here, it wasn't too expensive.
Well, other Americans have gone there, and they've come back with a little bit of training, but you went whole hog, didn't you?
It was the longest time until recently anybody's ever stayed there. I stayed there for 2 years and became the first American to ever be accepted as a disciple at the temple. So it was quite extensive.
That meant becoming completely immersed in Chinese culture?
It was, well, there were no other foreigners, so there was no choice. It was total immersion.
And I assume you were always seen as the foreigner, no matter what.
Yeah, the word they use is Lawai, and you would walk along the streets, and the tourists would point at you and go, look, there's a Lawai, there's a Lawai. So, yeah, you did have the experience of being a bit of a circus animal.
And then there's the culture shock, isn't there? For example, people show affection differently in China.
Yes. Well, the very interesting thing is that same-sex affection, boys and boys and girls with girls, but they don't show it across boys and girls together. So
that means holding hands.
They would hold hands or put their arm around you and walk arm in arm. So coming from Kansas, where that's very uncommon, it did trip me out a bit, but you got used to it over time.
And in this country, people would see that as having a homosexual aspect. Not in China?
No, not at all in China. In fact, one of the monks came up and asked me, you know, are there homosexuals in the U.S.? And I said, well, of course, there's homosexuals everywhere. And he said, not in China. So I think there was...
You didn't disabuse him.
I did not disabuse him of the notion. I couldn't. So in rural China, there was a very strong sense that that was an oddity that they weren't aware of.
My guest is Matthew Polly, who has written American Shaolin, Flying Kicks, Buddhist Monks, and The Legend of the Crotch, an Odyssey in the New China. Talk about the training for a moment. Can you explain what eating bitter is?
Yeah, the word is churku in Chinese, and the idea of eating bitter was the ability to suffer. And the Chinese felt that by training kung fu, you should suffer. Because if you've suffered enough, then when you're actually in a fight, there's nothing worse that can happen to you.
But that seems very un-Buddhist to me.
I think it is in a weird way, but the Buddhism, the way it's practiced in China, is very rigorous and very tough in the sitting meditation.
So did you really suffer a lot? Did that gain you any respect?
That was the funny thing, is that the only ways to get respect were to either be good at kung fu or to be able to eat a lot of bitter. And since I wasn't very good at kung fu, I had to eat a lot of bitter. So I did. I practiced harder than the Chinese did. And over time, they sort of they gave me a nickname, Lao Bao, for, you know, the ability to suffer and to work hard.
Can you give us an idea of what the most well-trained monks are physically capable of?
Well, one of the monks, monk De Qing, was able to actually run across the wall, 8, 9, 10 steps. And so he was always frustrated he couldn't get to 11 steps.
But running horizontally, in effect.
Horizontally across the wall. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Did you ever try that?
I did. I could do 2. No one else could do that many, but he definitely had this incredible ability. The monks were the most well-trained athletes and martial artists I've ever seen in my whole life.
What's iron kung fu?
Iron kung fu is the ability to take a particular part of your body and make it like iron, to harden it through repeated beatings. So I studied iron forearm, which involved me banging my forearms against trees 30 minutes every morning. And, of course, in the title, there was a monk who was an expert in iron crotch.
Iron crotch meaning that you could kick him in the crotch and he would not show any pain?
That's exactly right, and I know that for a fact because the monks asked me to do that. I actually didn't want to because, you know, kicking a Buddhist monk in the groin, you end up reincarnated as a dung beetle. But they forced me to.
You'll only know in the next life.
I only in the next life will I find out if that's really true. But it didn't bother him at all. I hurt my foot on him.
But I'd imagine that some of these things could actually really damage a body.
They do have a kind of a long-term consequence. For example, all the Iron Headmasters had a stutter.
So you get some brain damage, I'm sure. You get concussions.
You probably do. But the idea is that the dedication and the devotion that they serve actually helps them later on with their Buddhist training.
What about medicine? They I'm sure, only practice traditional Chinese medicine.
At the time, there was no Western medicine, so I ended up hurting my knees, and one of the doctors treated me with a herbal medicine, and I asked him what was in it, and he said, well, it's secret, but I'll tell you one item, and it turned out to be rat skin. So he was rubbing rat skin and various other herbs on my knees, and it worked. He healed me.
And then if you have to ingest some of these things, they make a tea out of it, probably the foulest smelling tea I've ever had to smell, but give you some raisins to sweeten it after you
That's
talk
exactly
about
right.
eating bitter.
Exactly. Yeah. No, everything of Shaolin was a little bit bitter.
So did you learn anything about Chinese medicine as a result?
I did. I studied a little bit with him, but they were very secretive about their Chinese medicine skills. So I learned a lot more about the Buddhism and the Kung Fu.
When did the press get wind of the fact that there was this white guy training at the Shaolin Temple?
Well, it was very funny because the international press community loves to do stories about the Shaolin Temple, PBS, the BBC. So they would come and then they would discover that there was a white guy there. So I was on all sorts of programs. The most important thing, though, was the mainland Chinese TV loved to use me as an example of a Westerner who appreciated Chinese culture. They were very proud.
What about their appreciation of outside culture? You describe watching kung fu movies with the monks. What did they think of them?
I think they thought most kung fu movies were a little silly.
Especially the flying?
The flying part. I mean, they just accepted it as part of their culture. But the one funny story is that I showed them Kung Fu with David Carradine. And they looked at it and they said, but he's white. He can't be a monk. I said, well, he is. And they said, but his kung fu's not very good. And I said, well, you know.
And the kid wasn't a grasshopper.
Exactly. The kid was not a grasshopper.
You also engage in a challenge match. Is this an important moment in the training?
Well, it was a significant moment in my life there because afterwards, that was sort of the moment I became accepted. Yes, a master from the north challenged the Shaolin monks, and I offered to fight him, thinking they wouldn't accept me doing that. And so it was a kind of faux offer, but it turns out they wanted me to fight him, and so I did. I went and I fought a challenge match on behalf of the Shaolin Temple.
And beat him.
I found a flaw in his defense. There's a saying that even a poor chess student can come up with a remarkable move. And I came up with a remarkable move and won. Yeah.
That must have raised your status within the temple.
It did. They started to call me Lao Bao, which is the nickname they gave me afterwards. And so the younger monks kind of treated me. It was a little like an honorary mascot, as it was.
Up until this point, did they think you were just there to learn some kung fu? When did they realize that you were serious enough to invite to join the order?
It took actually 2 years before they invited me to join the order, but it took 3 or 4 months before they realized that I was serious enough that they should treat with respect. At first, they just thought I would stay a little bit and go away.
Could you have stayed there the rest of your life?
You know, it was being the only white guy on top of a mountain in the middle of rural China in the early 90s was not easy. So at a certain point, I felt it was time to come home.
You haven't gone back?
I have gone back. I went back, and the epilogue I write about this, I went back after 10 years to do a sort of 10-year reunion. And it changed dramatically.
In what way?
Well, they had gotten rid of a lot of the kind of tourist trappiness around the temple, and it was a lot more peaceful than when I showed up, when it was really kind of Branson, Missouri.
How do you keep up with your training?
I just got back from Thailand. I wrote a piece for Slate about Muay Thai kickboxing. So I've been studying a lot of different cultures and different styles of kung fu.
But I'm sure that if you were to meet a master now, you'd get your butt kicked.
No, you've
got to do this every day, don't you?
Yeah, you do have to work out every day, and Chinese humility requires that I say, of course. Of course I would.
And did you do the whole thing, have your hair cut and wear a saffron robe?
I became a disciple, but not officially a monk. So unless you're a monk, you don't shave your head. So I didn't do that. I had a little problem with the vow of celibacy.
Matthew Polly's book, American Shaolin, after all, that was one of the things you wanted to correct in those things that were wrong about that.
That's absolutely right.
The last thing you want to do is to keep that one going.
Uh-huh.
American Shaolin, Flying Kicks, Buddhist Monks, and the Legend of Iron Crotch, an Odyssey in the New China. It's published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.